The following is a presentation of GalacticNetcasts.com.
We interrupt this program to give you a bulletin just received from one of our naval units at sea. A large object traveling at supersonic speed is headed over the North Atlantic toward the east coast of the United States.
This earth of yours will be reduced to a burned-out cinder.
This could be the beginning of the end for the human race. Human beings cower before the onslaught of these unearthly enemies.
It is Thursday, October 23rd, 2014. Welcome again to another Galactic Netcast. This is the Alien Invasion number 121. I'm Dave Nelson. Joining me as always is Mr. Brad Ludwig. And Inessa Moyens absent tonight. What is her excuse, Brad?
She is feeling under the weather. I think the Wisconsin weather with the changes, and now we're getting frost, and it's been pretty damp lately, and I think she just finally got hit with a fall cold.
So her Texas biology is not quite used to the Wisconsin weather yet, is what you're saying.
Yeah, not quite there. I give it a couple of years, and then she'll be okay.
So before we get into the show, I have to apologize to all of our listeners, all of our subscribers. If you are subscribed to our audio feeds, I have to apologize for some wonkiness that may have happened this week when you went to, like, update the podcast or whatever. Who'd have thought that just adding a few lines of URL to a bunch of the entries on the podcast feed would totally screw it up? And I apologize. I hope it wasn't too inconvenient for you.
And theoretically, it might even sort itself out, so...
Oh, no, they're all fixed. They're all fixed. It's just they're all in reverse order. They're all in weird orders, so you may be getting, like, episode 62 as a new episode this week. That's the only issue that remains, is they're in the wrong order, and hopefully that will fix over time. So, but again, I apologize if there's any confusion, if you were getting old episodes, new, that kind of thing. We're sorry. All right, on with the show. This is the Netcast, where we talk about aliens, the extraterrestrial kind, and where you can see them in film, TV, video games, comic books, science, real life, you name it. If E.T. is there, if a little green man is there, we talk about it in different ways than you may expect sometimes, which you may find out here in a few minutes. The show is divided into three sections. The news, the craft corner, that's the spotlight of a certain kind of alien spacecraft, and our picks for the week. If you want to watch us record the show, we do it Wednesdays or Thursdays, depending on guest schedules and that kind of thing. Either way, best thing to find out when and where that's going to be, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Google+. And the pages to do that is, the pages to watch us would be galacticnetcasts.com/live. Or at youtube.com/galacticnetcasts. Have I covered everything, Brad?
I think so.
All right.
I think you all certainly have.
Let's get it going then.
In the news.
And I kind of alluded to places where you may not necessarily think that there are aliens. And this kind of falls into the science category because these planets may hold life. You never know. So what do you got, Brad?
Well, this just popped up today on io9. We've been talking a lot about exoplanets, and by we I mean us on the show, but also the scientific community. But exoplanets are kind of the next stage and the next thing that we're looking for to find, not necessarily even intelligent alien life, but just alien life in general.
And to define define exoplanets real quick for people that may not know what that means.
Oh, I'm sorry. Exoplanets are just planets that are outside of our solar system. There are other solar systems, or maybe just singular planet around a star of any type. And we're going to be talking in a second about how there's been a lot of talk starting in 1992 when some of the first exoplanets were identified, but maybe those weren't the first ones identified.
Okay, hang on. That deserves something special like this. Not the first exoplanet. What are you talking about, Brad Ludwig?
Well, there's a gentleman, a Dutch astronomer by the name of Adrian van Manen, and he's working out of the Mount Wilson Observatory near Los Angeles. And he worked out of that location. And in 1917, he discovered one of the first white dwarf stars, and the nearest to our sun, which is only 14 light years away, which in galactic scales is right next door.
Wait a second. That's the closest star besides our sun to us.
According to this, yes.
Okay.
And this star was named in his honor as Van Manen 2. So he must have discovered another star at one point in time. But this Van Manen 2 is the one that's 14 light years away. Now, when he did this research, he noted some things that were kind of peculiar. And this other gentleman, he's a physicist and astronomy professor at UCLA, has gone through his notes on white. He's a white star, white dwarf specialist, and a white dwarf like our sun is a kind of an average star, but a white dwarf star is, you know, by the name, by its very definition, it's a much smaller, denser star, and it typically, they're I don't know if they're necessarily brighter, but our sun is obviously yellow, and this is a much brighter color in the white range, so probably a when Van Manen had written his notes, he noted that the photosphere of the white dwarf it had a different spectrum. We talk about spectral analysis. You can determine, and that's what they use for exoplanet and star classifications to better understand what composition is what the planet or the sun is made out of. Okay. And they do that by kind of splitting up the spectrum of the light that it gives off. And they can identify that certain elements tend to have different colors in the spectrum of the light.
The light given off by the star or
or reflected off of the planet.
Okay.
Obviously, a planet is not a natural light source, but they can tell by the reflected light off of the planet what it may be composed of. And a lot of that is atmospheric gases. But if there is life on a planet, you're going to find more methane, more carbon dioxide, more gases that are associated with breathing, living life on a planet. So as this physicist, Ben Zuckerman, was going through some of Van Manen's notes, he noticed that there are inconsistencies. A white dwarf should only contain hydrogen and helium, which are the gases that are used to power fusion, which is what the sun's process of generating the energy that it does. But what he noticed is that this particular white dwarf had other elements in it which come from asteroids, from debris, material orbiting around this white dwarf star. And they show up in... Let's see. Indeed, various studies of the spectral characteristics of this debris have revealed the makeup of asteroids orbiting the stars, other stars. One question that Zuckerman and others have puzzled over is why asteroids are regularly falling into white dwarfs. And this has led them to a fascinating discovery. It turns out that all of these white dwarfs are surrounded by rocky debris and at least one large planet. So as this debris is orbiting the star, the gravity of this planet, this exoplanet, is actually kind of moving this asteroid material around. I'm trying to think of a good way to
Is it the inertia from the planet that's causing that to
the disturbances of this planet are causing asteroids to collide with each other and then go into the white dwarf.
Okay.
So they're actually getting pulled in by the gravity of the white dwarf. And they're finding that these the white dwarfs with have heavy elements in their spectra, and that's from the asteroid, the material that's being burned up by the white dwarf.
That's amazing that they can figure all that out by the spectrum. It just that boggles the mind.
Yeah, and with our technology getting obviously far out of 1917, imagine what we're going to just think about that space, that span of time, 100 years. Imagine 100 years from now what we'll be able to do and discover if we keep on this current trajectory of discovery and scientific curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
If we can keep the funding up for
if the world doesn't go to crap, if the environment doesn't go to crap, if the world doesn't go to war with itself, if we keep civilized and the environment stays good, then I think we'll be great in 100 years.
Theoretically, yeah.
So I have a question. What about the white dwarf makes it so special that it attracts these asteroids?
Well, I think that, and the reason why this, and I did edit some stuff out of this story, and I found this story on IO9, as we find a lot of our stories. Mm-hmm. But the curious thing about this is that what von Manen had discovered was the white dwarf, but he missed the planet.
Okay.
That's the kind of the – he was close. He found this dwarf and didn't ask the right questions or may not have had the right data or may not have been able to gather the data to go that step further and ask the question, there's some anomalies here with this white dwarf. Why is that? And that's because there's an exoplanet in that vicinity of that white dwarf.
And they may not have had the knowledge to figure that out either back in 1919, you said, or
1917. Yeah.
Interesting.
And I think that nobody, I think at that time, really thought that solar systems could be that close to us.
Mm-hmm.
We were looking at Andromeda. We were looking in the distance, and we hadn't thought to look next door. And I think that might have been part of the issue of the oversight.
And at that time, people were still thinking that there might be like beings or aliens on Mars as well.
Sure. Yep.
So
you're very, very right.
It was a very different world back in 1917.
as ludicrous as it almost sounds to say those words, it's really true, especially from a scientific aspect.
I mean, Jesus, 1950, they were still, in the 50s and early 60s, they were still making movies with Martians in it, with Martians as the antagonist or the protagonist.
Well, Einstein's theory of general relativity was at least 25 years away.
Yep.
from this point. So, mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of the things that we build our knowledge of physics and astrophysics and whatnot hadn't really gotten to the level or close to the level that we know it to be now, and a lot of the groundwork was laid, wouldn't be laid for at least another quarter century for us to make some of the discoveries that we're making today.
So using our technology that we have today, do we know anything more about this potential exoplanet, like what the environment might be, what the atmosphere might be?
The story really didn't go into that further, and that would be a very interesting bit of knowledge to get. And let me see.
Well, if Kepler hasn't looked at this system, we may not know, or any other telescopes, we may not know anything about this system. It's just going off old data from 1917.
Yeah. Now, the white dwarf, and I'm looking on Wikipedia, so take it for what it's worth. It's in the constellation of Pisces, or in that general vicinity.
Yes,
where
Pisces.
You would observe it. And it's a white dwarf, so it's no longer It's saying here it's no longer generating energy, having about 68% of the sun's mass, but only 1.1% of the sun's radius. So it's a very dense star.
So is it cooler than yellow stars?
That's a very good question. The temperature. Okay, I have a temperature here. Let me.
My favorite kind of star is the pulsar, because it's like this. Because it's like the star is almost going out. It's like, you know, like a light bulb keeps on flickering because it's about to go out. My favorite kind. Sorry for making you do research on the fly.
No. There we go. Okay. So, well, here we go. Temperature. Crap. Oh, okay. There we go. So 1.57 times 10 to the 7th power Kelvin is ours. No, the white dwarf seems to be much cooler if I'm looking at this right.
Okay.
Because the white dwarf is 6,220 plus or minus 240 Kelvin.
Gotcha.
Five times. Yeah, so it's much cooler.
All right.
So for this planet to have life on it, would have to be very close to the star to get a relative amount of warmth to support life on it.
Yeah, I have my doubts about life on this planet, especially given all those asteroids hanging out there. I'm guessing it might get bombarded from time to time if, you know, who knows?
Yeah
we're not there.
Now, it's saying here, possible companion. The possible existence of a substellar companion remains uncertain. As recently as 2004, there was one paper confirming and one denying its detection. As of 2008, observations with the Spitzer Space Telescope appear to rule out any companions within 1,200 astronomical units of the star that have four Jupiter masses or greater. Okay. So... So any material, you know, they're not a companion star, but at least that they do know that there is material orbiting it. So
what was the name of that system again?
Well, it's in the constellation Pisces.
It was close to the top of the story, the very beginning of the story. You mentioned it. It's his name, I think.
Oh, the star is Von Manen 2.
Yeah, I was mentioning this earlier. That sounds like a Star Trek system name or a Star Trek planet name.
Either that or a very strange Dutch sequel film.
Yeah.
Von Manen 2, more Von Manen.
Yeah. He's a great director. I like him. A lot of action in his films.
He's an amazing director.
All right. Thank you very much, Brad. Before we move on to the next story, you have to talk about your shirt that you're wearing tonight. If you're not watching us on the live stream or on YouTube, or if you can't see it, if you are watching us, come on, open it up there. All right.
There we go. So I'm in Wisconsin, and it's kind of chilly. So I'm wearing my kind of typical garb during this time of year, which is my fleece bathrobe, which is brown. It's very nice and warm. I'm wearing my sweatpants, but I'm wearing my short sleeve shirt underneath the
robe.
Oh my God, my robe. Jeez. But there is an artist who put out a series of T-shirts, and they're all done in the style of a service and repair manual. And the one that I'm wearing today is the Weyland-Yutani Corp. Power Loader P5000 Powered Work Loader Service and Repair Manual. And it has the Weyland-Yutani logo on it. And it's got a kind of a silhouetted figure inside of the power armor. And this is the power armor that Ripley wore in Aliens 2.
Yep.
And at the bottom of the shirt, it gives specific things that it highlights as to what it can repair. I have one that's the TARDIS. Which lists, information on the chameleon circuit, which is obviously something that is not working on the TARDIS. And I have the Serenity ship Firefly.
Yeah, I remember that. I remember seeing that one. I don't remember seeing the one that you're wearing tonight, though.
And yeah, he's done all sorts of different shirts for different science fiction based movies and television programs, for repair manuals for ships. I'm still waiting for the day that he creates a shirt for the DeLorean from Back to the Future.
Yeah, that would be pretty cool.
I would buy that shirt in a hot second.
What's this guy's name? Do you know what's his name?
Ah, that's a very good question.
I'm always stumping you, Brad. I'm always like... Hey, while you do that, let me just remind the listeners and viewers that you can get a hold of us. A couple of different ways you can contact Galactic Netcasts. Our email address is galacticnetcasts, I know it's a lot of S's and T's, @gmail.com, galacticnetcasts@gmail.com, or call our voicemail number and leave a message, or send us a text via that number as well, 805-328-3966, 805-328-3966. We'd love any kind of comments or suggestions or just a smart-ass remark about the show. Anything negative or positive, we want to hear it via feedback. All right, Brad.
So he's done a number of shirts, and unfortunately I've gone to his full page, but I'm showing the TARDIS shirt. But he's done one for the for Star Fox, which is a game.
That's cool.
Here's the Serenity Firefly shirt. Here is the power, and this is all visual stuff, so you're able to see this on the video, unfortunately. But there's also the Viper.
Ooh, Viper
from Battlestar Galactica.
Mark II.
Yep, and here is, and this is the design for the new series.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the design for the Cylon Raider from the new series.
Yep.
But they also have a shirt for the Warthog, which is from the Halo series.
Hey, speaking
and they've got the Tumbler from Batman from Wayne Enterprises.
Speaking of Halo, did you see the trailer for the movie? The live action movie?
No, I have not yet.
It's very cool.
Nice.
I don't know anything about Halo, but the movie looks awesome. Or a TV show or whatever it is. Live action. It's the Ridley Scott produced thing on Xbox.
Oh, okay. Sure. Yeah.
All right. Let's move on to the second story of the night. We're only doing two news stories because Inessa is absent. But I think this makes up for lack of a third story, in my opinion. Archie meets... Okay, you're wearing the Alien shirt, right? Alien has met Predator before. Now, Predator is going to meet Archie. I'll let that sink in for a second. Archie is going to meet Predator in a new comic book crossover series. Huh. I know. It's odd.
I remember when Archie met Punisher.
That's 1994, right?
Yeah,
it's on the story here. Yeah. 1994, Archie and the Riverdale crew met the Punisher. And at that point, that was the weirdest crossover event ever. But this may trump that. So last week, the publisher announced a new partnership with Dark Horse Comics that will merge the Archie and Predator franchises in one violent, surreal crossover. Archie Meets Predator will be a four-issue miniseries planned for a spring 2015 release. Okay. I'm kind of pausing between sentences to let this all sink in.
You kind of need to digest that because that's very, very weird.
Okay. Let me ask you this. I don't think this could have been done like back in the, 1994, I guess, the Punisher met Archie, but maybe pre that, sometime before that. Do you think this could have happened?
No, at that time, I don't know if they still have the rights, but Dark Horse had the rights for the comic book rights for Alien and Predator.
Okay, but just the whole scheme of thing, like the just generally in the comic book universe. Do you think we were prepared for something like this?
No, not even a little bit.
Do you think it's? Do you think it's because the popularity is so much more for comic books and comic book characters and comic book franchises in today's world?
I think that, and now we've kind of taken a turn into comic book talk. I think that Archie Comics has really struggled to remain relevant. There, if you look at the stories from Archie Comics over the past few years, you know, they had their first gay character.
Well, they've
recently.
got the two different universes. They've got Archie Prime, then they've got the one where the first gay character and some other Archie was killed, I believe, in that universe.
Yeah. So I think that they had struggled with being caught in a certain time period, or people just having the perception of them being the funny comic book that their grandparents used to read, or their, you know, we've kind of reached that point in time. Archie Comics actually had their own line of superhero comics at one point in time.
Really?
Yes, they did. And they ended up selling those properties to DC Comics in the early 90s. And which is the Black Hood, Shield, the Human Fly, the Human Comet, the Cheetah. Yeah, I'm probably getting that one wrong. But they had so DC had their sideline, like a different universe of comics that they did and used those characters. And they were some pretty interesting stories, and they had some pretty interesting artists and writers that are still in the business today that worked on that. And I think now Archie Comics is actually going to be Dark Circle comic book line, which is going to have superheroes, which is going to be separate from the Archie, Veronica, and Betty universe, and having a line of superhero comics again. So,
oh, that's cool. Okay, so they're.
I guess the point I'm trying to make is they're in the process of trying to remake themselves and making partnerships that people are going to talk about, which we're doing right now. That's kind of the purpose of this, is to, you know, you get Predator and maybe you get other properties that are willing to work with them and get people talking about the Archie properties and get people introduced to that and you know, maybe pick up sales. So,
and I think people love weird crossovers and mashups as well in this day and age. So it fits perfectly.
Yeah. You know, anything that's well written and well done, people are willing to shell out the cash for. So hopefully that works out well for them.
Hang on one second. All right. Just sending a message. The wife. Okay. So, what was I saying? So Archie meets Predator in the publisher's latest foray into mature readers, like you just talked about, trying to build that audience once again. Writer Alex DeCampi told USA Today that the story begins as Jughead wins a contest and the Riverdale crew take a trip to sunny Costa Rica for spring break. After putting Betty in his sights, the Predator will follow the gang back to Riverdale and begin the hunt in earnest. DeCamp said the concept... I'm glad that somebody's on the ball for that. DeCampi said the concept appealed to her because it's just completely insane. Let's take this gentle, beloved, classic teen cast and hunt them down and slaughter them one by one. See, that's... That's the cool part right there. Maybe this is a way to get rid of that universe of Archie and start over again with a clean slate. Predator takes them all out.
Maybe.
Yeah. That's cool. I've been, as you are aware, Brad, and maybe the listeners are aware, I've been kind of educating myself on comic books as of late, and now I'm curious about the superheroes that they had back in the day. I want to read up on those now. That's interesting.
Yeah. Well, Archie was, you know, they were looking to make money. They had these properties and they ended up selling them to DC. And DC, Fawcett Comics, the comic company that owned the Shazam properties, Captain Marvel, they sold to DC. Charlton Comics had a line of superhero comics that they ended up, you know, DC ended up picking up in the early 80s. So, you know, it's one of those things where a company has property, and if somebody's willing to buy it, they sell it to help them out or kind of better focus what they have as opposed to, you know, diversifying everything.
And so that just adds to their universe, makes it richer and deeper.
Yes. Very much so.
All right. That is your news. Let's move on to this.
Please identify the craft you witnessed.
A black, triangular, three-dimensional shape. Huge. Just flying, hovering in it.
Shaped like almost like between an egg and like a teardrop.
Two long cylinder objects flying over me.
We had a zone. I could see the occupants in it.
It appeared to be rotating, and it was circular to disc shape, and it hovered for maybe about 5 minutes.
All right, it's time for Craft Corner, a.k.a. famous alien spacecraft in history. And tonight, on this episode, we're going to kind of focus on one particular kind that has only been witnessed, or it's only been a phenomenon in one part of the world. It's called ghost rockets. That sounds cool, doesn't it? Ghost rockets.
It sounds like a comic book title, actually.
Yeah, it does, totally. Yeah, definitely. Good point. It's rocket or missile-shaped unidentified flying objects sighted in 1946. So this is a very particular thing that we're talking about, and mostly in Sweden and nearby countries. And there might be a reason for that, which I will bring up here in a couple seconds. About 2,000 sightings were logged between May and December 1946. 200 sightings were verified with radar returns. And authorities recovered physical fragments which were attributed to ghost rockets. Ghost rockets. Whoever came up with that name is a genius. Investigations concluded that many ghost rockets sightings were probably caused by meteors. However, most ghost rocket sightings did not occur during meteor shower activity, and furthermore displayed characteristics inconsistent with meteors, such as its reported maneuverability. So supposedly these ghost rockets could actually change direction and that kind of thing.
Excuse me.
It was first thought that they originated from a former German rocket facility and were long-range tests by the Russians of captured German V-1 and V-2 missiles, which would make total sense because this is right after World War II, and I'm sure that those are the rockets that they recovered, which they eventually used in their manned space program. That theory was rejected by Swedish, British, and U.S. military investigators because no recognizable rocket fragments were ever found, and according to some sightings, the objects usually left no exhaust trail. Some moved slow or too slowly and usually flew horizontally. They sometimes traveled and maneuvered in formation, and they were usually silent. Now, later on... was it that same year? I believe it was that later on that year, they actually brought in an expert from the U.S. who concluded that indeed it was probably from that Russian base. So the early, I guess, analysis of that theory was wrong, and they probably were from that Russian base. But it was fun. It was fun for a few months, thinking that they were extraterrestrials. So the sightings most often consisted of fast-flying rocket or missile-shaped objects with or without wings, visible for mere seconds. A hissing or rumbling sound was sometimes reported. On October 10, 1946, the Swedish Defense Staff publicly stated, "Most observations are vague and must be treated very skeptically. In some cases, however, clear, unambiguous observations have been made that cannot be explained as natural phenomena." Swedish aircraft... phenomena.
Sorry.
That's okay. I appreciate the phenomena joke. Swedish aircraft or imagination on the part of the observer. That was from the last sentence I said. echo radar and other equipment registered readings but gave no clue as to the nature of the objects. There was actually one incident where the military... what do they call that? Dragged? Yeah, they dragged a body of water, a lake, and they found no evidence because witnesses said that the ghost missile crashed or ghost rocket crashed in this body of water and they never found it. So, interesting, cool mystery in the year 1946, but it was probably most likely the V-1 and V-2 missiles that Russia took from Germany. And that is your Craft Corner. Craft of the week. Any questions that you have, Brad, on this?
No. I That is really, really peculiar and very interesting.
Yeah, exactly.
Whenever we talk about that portion of the world, I always think of the Nordics, the Nordic aliens.
Yeah, exactly. And it's funny because there's a story out in the last week or so that I think it's either the Swedes or the Norwegians are searching for an unidentified object under the ocean. They think it's the Russians. Stupid Russians again, causing more problems. They're saying it's very similar to, it harkens back to the Soviet Union days. But it's kind of funny. It's kind of sort of related. They're searching a body of water for something Russian related. So,
those freaking guys. Yeah.
This was an interesting time because, you know, the next year, obviously, we had the birth of UFOs and flying saucers with the Roswell crash in 1947. And what's his face that coined the flying saucer name? I think it was in Washington State where he saw a bunch of unidentified flying objects that he thought looked like they were skipping across the sky.
Oh, yeah, yep.
Like flying saucers. That's where the name came from. So, all right. That is your Craft Corner here on the Alien Invasion. Let's skip to our picks, our final segment of the show. These are things that we've watched, listened to, read, just taken into our senses over the last couple weeks. And Anessa, if she was here, would have been first with Tales of Tomorrow. I guess we'll have to wait until next week to find out what exactly that is. But Brad, you're next in the lineup. What is your pick this week?
Well, I, you know my love of the classic 1950s black and white sci-fi films. This is a sort of a remake of a classic 50s film that Tobe Hooper did. And Tobe Hooper did Poltergeist and, oh gosh, a number of other films. And it's a remake of Invaders from Mars. And Invaders from Mars is a story about a kid who he loves astronomy and loves the stars, and he ends up witnessing a craft land behind his house in a small canyon. And then his father goes out and says that, you know, I'll take a look at it in the morning. And when he comes back, he's different. So what you end up finding is that this ship has landed and is slowly taking over the people in this town. And some interesting facts about this. The kid's mom is played by Lorraine Newman, and Lorraine Newman was a groundling, which is a member of the improv comedy troupe. I think they were based in Los Angeles and Hollywood.
Yeah, you're right.
But she's really more famously known as being on Saturday Night Live.
Yep.
So it was kind of interesting to see her play a serious role. And there's bits that are tongue-in-cheek, and this movie definitely takes place in present day, but there's a certain design sensibility to it that kind of gives a nod to the 50s, which is – it's hard to describe, but when you watch it, there's a certain way that certain people dress that – really make you kind of think back to that time period. Also, another interesting tidbit that I found out is that Stan Winston was working on this film and made the aliens and some of the effects work, but he was also working on Alien at the same time.
Oh, this would be Aliens because it's 1986.
Aliens. Yeah, I'm sorry, Aliens. So I there's no real... I mean, he was a true master. You didn't really see bits of the same, you know, the same style of work on different aliens and things like that. Every alien looked unique and different in its own way. But it's just really kind of interesting to think that he was kind of pulling double duty and doing two sci-fi suspense / horror films at the same time. And the creatures in this are phenomenal.
I'm guessing he got paid though more for Aliens than he did for this film, possibly.
Yeah, I would say that that's a fairly accurate assessment. I don't know. I mean, he definitely wasn't as big as he was towards the end of his life, but I'm sure he pulled his fair share of cash for doing effects work. And when you look at practical effects, and these creatures are not, I mean, CG just really wasn't done. It was cost prohibitive. It took so long to do just simple things. And you see these creatures, and they are amazing, very complex, and they are very large aliens when you finally see them. And they have essentially four limbs that they move about on. And I couldn't even imagine what it would have been like to be inside of that suit to make everything happen, to move around in it. But it's just phenomenal when you watch this and you think about just that aspect. I mean, now you'd throw in a CG monster. It just really isn't done. Although we are seeing J.J. Abrams kind of make a return to more practical aliens with the tidbits that we've seen of Star Wars, the new Star Wars film. But to think back in 1986, mm-hmm. and he's making quality, large creatures that are practical, it just blows my mind. And maybe it doesn't blow anybody else's mind, but just to look at that and go, wow, you know, that's how they did it then.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that kind of stuff after watching a full season of Face Off, the reality yeah. makeup competition, because those guys put a lot of work into what they do, and they're just doing it for a reality show. I can't yeah. imagine what the hours and the work that goes into making like a number of aliens for a full-fledged feature film.
Yeah. It's you only really see maybe two or three of these creatures at any point in time, but they are as tall as a 6-foot person, but they're bulky. You know, they've got two of their legs are larger. There's two of them that are smaller that they kind of help move and do things with. But they're basically legs in a head. The head is just enormous. And God, to move around in that thing, and it must have been really hot in those suits. But they're just complex and just mind-numbing to look at doing something that large. And when I think of a creature that big, I usually think of Jim Henson's, you know, workshop mm-hmm. with the creatures that they made for, say, Dark Crystal, or to a lesser extent, Big Bird or Snuffleupagus as larger creatures. But whew. Anyways, I digress. It's really kind of cool to look back at the history of sci-fi films and see a practical effect monster that's that large and know that Stan Winston made that, and it's just phenomenal to look at. All in all, it's a very slightly disturbing film. I kind of wonder if the faculty doesn't take a little bit from Invaders from Mars.
Yeah. Same kind of vibe. Kind
of has that kind of vibe. It all, I mean, you know, one of the common threads is it takes place at a school, but it has that conspiratorial, you can't trust the establishment, you can't trust the teachers, you can't trust your parents, you don't know who's infected and who's not, and all that going on. And that's what really kind of adds to the suspense of the film. And obviously, this is 1986, so the technology, looking at some of the technologies like, you know, the rotary telephone and things that just aren't seen or used today. It doesn't seem that long ago, but things definitely changed from that point in time. So it's on Netflix, and it's about an hour and a half, 2 hours. If you want to see classic 1980s send up of a 1950s sort of a film and watch Stan Winston's work, I highly, highly recommend watching it. The acting is kind of B-horror movie quality.
I was going to ask you what the acting was like, or the story even. Was the story, was it written halfway decently?
The story was written well. The acting was pretty good, but not at the level of
because they blew their budget on the makeup and the effects.
Yeah, I think they spent a lot of their money on Stan Winston and some of the effects that they did. And they got who they got, and they did a fairly good job. There were just some aspects of it that just weren't. I didn't feel all of the emotional suspense and all the emotions that you should have felt, and some of the dialogue was a bit cheesy. But then again, there's that point where, are they doing a send-up of 50s type dialogue and movie writing for that time period, or is this just that bad? You know, it rides the line of being so bad it's good.
I see.
So, okay. Yeah.
Got it. All right.
And it's Tobe Hooper. Poltergeist to me is one of the most, one of the scariest films that I think I've watched. And it's scary on two levels. When you watch it the first time as a kid, it's scary because there's monsters coming for you. And when you watch it as an adult after you've had children, it's now scary because monsters have taken your children. So it's a multi-layered sort of a horror film. So you know that Tobe Hooper did excellent work. So you just kind of look at this film and go, I think that he's giving a nod to the 50s, but I'm not quite sure.
Well, find out for yourself and check it out. Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. Put it in your queue. It's on Netflix. I'm sure it's going to be there a while, but yeah, give it a watch if you've got an hour and a half, 2 hours.
All right. I also went to the Netflix well and picked out a documentary for my pick this week. It's called Mirage Man, and it was really interesting because it was all about the counterintelligence from, I want to say, well, we mentioned 1947, the Roswell crash, that all the way up until just recent history. So it's a 2013 documentary about how the U.S. government used mythology about UFOs and aliens to cover up their advanced technology. So basically, they were kind of planting this fake story of UFOs and aliens to certain people, or given this information to certain people, to cover up the fact that what they saw really was actually, you know, advanced human technology that the government was developing to fight the Russians during the Cold War. It prominently features Richard Dottie, a retired special agent who worked for the U.S. Air Force Office of Special Investigation. And you get kind of the vibe at the very end that even the people, like, they interviewed him a lot in this documentary, and you kind of get the vibe like he said that there was real evidence, because they showed it in their briefings that there were such things as aliens and UFOs and, you know, unidentified flying objects. But he's like, well, the viewer is kind of like, well, maybe they were told that to cover up, you know, to make them think that there was actually real stuff out there, to make their lying to these people seem more true. I don't know if that's the case or not. Intelligence and espionage is always very, like, gray area stuff. Like, you don't know who's telling the truth. It's kind of like watching a spy movie, right? Because you don't know who, yeah, if the person's really good or really bad. It may turn out that they're actually on the good side, but, you know, it's one of those deals. But in real life, right? I mean, this is actually stuff that really happened.
Huh.
Like, there was people that were brought into offices by these agents and shown things and shown all this evidence that was all made up. Just imagine the time and effort and the people that went into making these cover-ups, these elaborate cover-ups, with, like, these documents and evidence that they were shown, all supposedly fake, to cover up the fact that the U.S. government was making all these advances in Defense Department stuff, right?
Yeah.
Oh, just to have all that government money for a program like that must have been just awesome. Let's just let's make up stuff with the millions and billions of dollars that we have in our budget. But it's cool. It's a cool, like, peek at our history that we're obviously not living anymore. Well, for the most part, this stuff may still go on, but it really went on in earnest back, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s during the Cold War. So I definitely recommend it. There's a lot of like UFO experts that you've seen before and a lot of other documentaries and a lot of other TV shows in this movie. People that you know, like Stanton Friedman, what's her name from? She's always on Coast to Coast AM. She does a report. She calls in a report every so often, and I wish I would have wrote her name down. But you would recognize her name if you're a follower of that kind of stuff, especially Coast to Coast AM. A great show.
Sure.
Linda Moulton Howell. She was on this documentary, and she was actually one of the people that were shown this fake information from these counterintelligence agents of the U.S. government. Check it out. It's on Netflix. It's Mirage Man. That is my pick for the week.
Wow, that is really interesting.
Yeah, it is really interesting. I was kind of blown away. I can't believe they actually, I could believe they actually pulled this off, but I was blown away by the scope of this program and how much work they put into fooling these people and giving them these false stories. This documentary started out by focusing in on one certain person whose his life was ruined because of this program. Like, he was like a business owner. He had money, he had a family, a wife, all of it gone because he was led to believe all this information. Like, he was basically turned into a fool by the U.S. government because he saw too much. It's very, like, sketchy. Like, you know, they went a little bit too far in some of these cases. Kind of makes you feel like the government has too much power in a way.
Yeah.
But again,
I would agree with that.
But again, you know, this is the Cold War, and they're fighting, you know, Russians, Soviets everywhere. So I can understand it, definitely. All right, we've got a picks page on our website, galacticnetcasts.com, where you can go and actually get links to these shows. And it goes through Amazon, and if you buy our picks through the website, galacticnetcast.com, you're actually supporting the network in a very small way. So again, check out our picks at galacticnetcasts.com. And while you're there, also get links to our social networks. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, or just Google us. Google our name or search for our name on those social networks and you will find us. Feedback number 805-328-3966 or galacticnetcasts@gmail.com. Subscribe to us now that our feeds are all fixed on iTunes, Stitcher. We're also on TuneIn Radio as well. So just search for Galactic Netcast in those places. And one more announcement before we get out of here. We have a new show coming to Galactic Netcasts. It's called Weird World Weekly. It's going to be a weekly short podcast, about 15 minutes in length each episode. It's hosted by myself and Matt Stein from the Sci-Fi Geeks Club and previously from the Sci-Fi Film School podcast. We've actually, I think, Matt and I have been doing shows longer than you and I, realistically, when you the history of Galactic Netcasts, because we were doing the Newbie and the Geek podcast before Alien Invasion. So it's possible that we may set a record, me and him, doing more podcasts than you and I. Maybe. I don't know. If you count up all the Alien Invasion and Sci-Fi Geeks Club and... No, you were never on Time Traveling Robots in Space. You were just a guest. But we may overtake you with the amount of shows that Matt and I have done over you and I eventually.
Sure.
So check it out. We'll be launching that on Halloween. It's called Weird World Weekly, and you'll get more information at galacticnetcasts.com. All right. Huh. Anything you got before we get out of here?
No, not really. Hopefully I'll be able to finish up my podcast table here pretty quick and work on my new show.
Yeah, we can grow the network even more.
Yep. It's finding the time and trying to build other things to try to get stuff out of the garage and into the house so we can sort through and get Anessa more fully integrated into the house. So
it's all about balance, my friend.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. I built built shelving in the basement this past weekend, so.
Well, good luck. Good luck.
Yeah, thank you, sir.
All right. That's going to do it for this Alien Invasion podcast, number 121, another Galactic Netcast in the books. And until next time, we'll talk to you later, Brad.
Sounds good. Thanks, Dave. Bye.
You have been listening to a presentation of GalacticNetcasts.com. For more about the show you just listened to, including how to subscribe, give us feedback, links to our social feeds, and more, please visit www.galacticnetcasts.com.